Hey, HG 101 fans, I want you to know that we're crowdfunding a brand new, gorgeously printed hardcover book covering 101 weird, obscure, historically important, and just plain cool Japanese video games. It's going to be called Hardcore Gaming 101 Presents Japanese Video Game Obscurities, but we can only put it out with your pledge. So check out hardcoregaming101.net. The link should be pretty much close to the top of the page. Japanese Video Game Obscurities. This is, if we get to do this, it's going to be our best looking book yet, and it's one of those books that it'll be about stuff you've probably never heard of. In fact, I can almost guarantee you won't have heard of almost all of it. So give a hoot, fund our book, $15 for the PDF, $20 plus shipping for the hardcover. Do it! Hello and welcome to episode 72 of HardcoreGaming101.net's top 47,858 games of all time podcast, where we objectively, definitively, and scientifically rank the games you nominate. My name is Xerxes, and there was nothing in Al Capone's vault, but it wasn't Cthulhu's fault. My panelists today are...
Theorusui.
And Sotanga.
And Carl. And Ryusui, it's great to have you back again. Have you been on this? You've been on this version of the show at least once, right?
I feel like I have. I just can't put my finger on when.
But you also helped us out a lot back in the game club days. So it's always great to have a game club alumnus back. On this podcast, we have three rules. Rule number one, all rankings are final, official, and scientifically accurate. Rule number two, you can nominate one game at a time via five-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play. Rule number three, you can nominate games that have already been nominated, but don't nominate games we've already ranked. You can see the master list for yourself. Check it out at bit.ly/47kgames. So the next game we're talking about is Shin Megami Tensei: Strange Journey, which was nominated by Leeby Bear on iTunes. Thanks for that 5-star review, Leeby Bear. It was developed by Atlus and Landcars and published by Atlus for the Nintendo DS. Earliest release date and territories: October 8th, 2009 in Japan. So who has something to say about Strange Journey?
I do.
I know that Ryusei probably has everything to say, but I'll try and keep up too.
Well, let me start out by being the dunce in the room here. I'll just tighten up my dunce cap. All right, excellent. What is the difference between this game and the other like mainline Shin Megami Tensei games?
And in immortal words of Strong Bad, not a whole lot. Basically, Strange Journey can be best summed up as Shin Megami Tensei 4 before we actually got a Shin Megami Tensei 4. Basically, in a lot of respects, Strange Journey is a throwback to the old dungeon crawlers of the Super NES days. Also to the original Persona, which had kind of a first-person dungeon crawler aesthetic as well. But basically, this is kind of a step back from Shin Megami Tensei 3, which had the full 3D environments like Shin Megami Tensei 4 went with. It's very much more of a traditional first-person dungeon crawler, but at the same time, it's, let's just say it's more modern in some respects than Shin Megami Tensei 3. For example, there are a number of new systems in play, like, for example, being able to learn new skills by maxing out your connection with your demon partners.
Yeah, so it's like Pokemon, except that Red learns from Pikachu.
Right. So
that is pretty much Shin Megami Tensei in a nutshell.
So maybe we should... yeah, but just for the benefit of our listeners who are not like Mega Ten super fans, the kinds of people who would use the portmanteau Mega Ten.
It's legal.
Yeah, which I'm not a super fan for. I just know that insufferable nickname. So it's better than Drakuei, though. Drakuei is the worst.
Oh no, not that crap.
It's a Japanese thing. See, it's a Japanese thing. Like, they have this this new speak like affinity for truncating names down to four characters, like Full Metal Alchemist or Hagane no Renkinjutsushi comes out to Hagaren, or again Shin Megami Tensei becomes Megaten. It's a neat way to crunch things down for space, but it does result in some things that are kind of impenetrable to a Western viewer and maybe seem a little pretentious.
Yeah, I appreciate this efficiency to a point, but you know, Shane Bettenhausen took the Drakuei ball and ran the hell out of it.
I love him for that.
I mean, we were all the poor. No, Shane's a really funny guy. I wish I wish he'd be on a podcast again. If he's not,
he does it because he knows that like it really tweaks people. Okay, so which is what makes it funny.
Anyway,
okay, so anyway, so for the our non Shin Megami Tensei super fans out there, can you explain like the basic mechanics? Because that's the first. This is the first one of these games I think we've ranked.
Okay, well, the reference to the comparison to Pokemon is quite apt. This is. Shin Megami Tensei basically predates Pokemon as far as the whole capture, train, and battle monsters concept goes, but more of a traditional RPG mode. Like, instead of being a heroic trainer who travels the land trying to be the best there ever was, instead, Shin Megami Tensei usually frames its story in terms of an impending apocalypse. Like, its monsters are demons, which in the franchise's parlance literally means monsters and gods, angels, etc., drawn from myths and legends the world over.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's something I really like about SMT. It's a real melting pot of like various cultures, pantheons. You have like Greek and Hindu and Shinto, like gods and demons, like the Ars Goetia, just about any like source of supernatural heaven and hell types of things and all that. It's and of course the fantastic artist Kazuma Kaneko has given life to these many fascinating creatures, and he is a freaking awesome artist. But no, he's cool. I was trying to think of a specific example of what a cool Kaneko design would be, but you kids probably know him as Dante's Devil Trigger in DMC3. But I am digressing heavily here. Yeah. Go on.
If you like Dante's Devil Trigger in DMC3, I heartily recommend the Digital Devil Saga games for PS2, also available as PS2 Classics on PS3, because they imagine basically a game where you play as a team of Power Rangers who do just that. They all
every
transform into demons with, or rather, awesome human-demon hybrid morphs. Also, you eat everybody else.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the devour
mechanic and pig out.
Yeah, we don't want to digress too much, but like the devour mechanic of that one, I guess, sort of takes over the demon team that you get in most of the other SMTs. But it is a bit of a deviation, thus not considered main one.
It's very much more of a traditional JRPG. Like if you're more into something like Final Fantasy than Pokemon, then the Digital Devil Saga games might be more up your alley. But yes, you're right, we are digressing rather heavily here. So, Strange Journey is itself a bit of digression. Like, one reason why it is not a Shin Megami Tensei 4 per se is that it does not take place in an apocalyptic Tokyo like most of the other mainline games do.
Instead, that's what I heard about.
It's really more of a sci-fi take on the premise. The protagonists are basically a squad of badass scientists, soldiers, etc., sent in on an exploratory team to investigate an anomaly that is spreading across Antarctica and threatening to consume the entire planet. What they find on the other side is the Schwarzwelt, or Dark World. Well, literally Black World in German, but can't resist that Legend of Zelda reference. So anyway, here in this, the Schwarzwelt. The Schwarzwelt is like a twisted reflection of humanity. Basically, the powers that be have deemed humanity unfit to further occupy this planet. And so the Schwarzwelt is like our judge, jury, and executioner. It's going to spread across the world until it consumes everything and remakes the world in its own image. And of course, your job at the onset is to figure out a way to stop it. But as per the norm for Shin Megami Tensei, you can choose screw humanity and side with either of the two major factions trying to remake the world in their own image. You can side with the angels and the gods and try to create a world of law where everybody basically lives under their fascist rule, or you can side with the forces of chaos and create a world of absolute anarchy. So generally, the really funny thing is that technically the game punishes you in Undertale style for picking either law or chaos, because if you pick one of those two routes, you'll end up having to fight basically the neutral representative, who I will not spoil the identity of because it's a pretty big spoiler, but basically he proceeds to go all sands on your ass if you decide you're going to betray humanity. I've never fought him for obvious reasons, but I have heard tell he is the toughest boss in the game, even counting the canonical final bosses.
Wow. Yeah, I never came across them either. That's pretty impressive to learn. But, yeah, this game, more than I think any other, sort of hammers in the fact that the neutral route is usually the, like, the closest thing to a best ending in any of these given games. And, of course, though, that's always tricky to hit, because it isn't like your alignment primarily based with the type of demons you manage to recruit, or there are other factors in the game that nudge things one way or the other.
Dialogue options. There are dialogue options throughout the course of the game, which nudge your alignment one way or another. One very nice thing is that it's kind of out of the way, but at the very end, before the alignment lock, there is an NPC conversation you can go through, which you can repeat indefinitely, and it will nudge your alignment one way or another. So if you don't like where you've landed on the spectrum, you can tweak your alignment. It's a bit of a repetitive process, but it can be done. Now, mind you, if you're still slightly into law or slightly into chaos, you can still choose the neutral route at the end. But if you are extremely one way or another, if I recall correctly, your alignment will be locked, and you will have no choice but to face the wrath of Sans Undertale.
it's ironic. We're spoiling something else for a game that came before the game we're spoiling. Well, that's Undertale's probably better known. I mean, I think Strange Journey was reasonably successful for its time, but until, you know, Persona 3 and 4 really broke massive, SMT series has always been kind of underground.
Actually, I'm pretty sure that if you check the dates, you'll find the Strange Journey was
after
Persona 3 and 4. Though, right. I will say that Persona is probably more firmly entrenched in the public conscious than the Shin Megami Tensei title. In fact, you might notice that Atlus tried to bootstrap the Shin Megami Tensei title by attaching it to the Persona games. Like, they were never called Shin Megami Tensei Persona 3 and Shin Megami Tensei Persona 4 in Japan. That was something Atlus came up with for marketing in the U.S., trying to put the Shin Megami Tensei name out there. Unless I am horribly mistaken, you will find that Persona 5 does not do this. It is just Persona 5, not Shin Megami Tensei Persona 5.
Okay, now that makes sense. I mean, for better or worse, it seems at least in the West, Persona has become the most popular branch of the series, and I have my own opinions on that, but I'm not going to get into them.
Yeah, well, all I can say is I will probably buy Persona 5 when it goes extremely on sale, because I've heard some things about the localization that I don't approve of.
Yeah. The translation has a lot of...
Which is really sad, because my experience with Shin Megami Tensei 4 and 4 Apocalypse and Strange Journey itself was nothing short of stellar. The only thing I can say I encountered in Apocalypse that was kind of questionable is that there are some strings, like for certain demon evolutions, that will pop up, and it's clear that somebody didn't go over them as well as they should have. And there's one for like the angel evolutions, if I recall, that's almost gibberish. And since we were talking about mythology earlier, I would say that Apocalypse probably, I probably learned more about Celtic mythology from Apocalypse than I knew. Period. But then again, I still only know about Dagda and Danu, who are the two central figures in Apocalypse's plot. And I should say this much: if you play Apocalypse for any reason, it would be for Dagda's performance in the dub. And it is an awesome game, but Dagda is like. Anyway, I'm still going on a tangent here.
we should probably do our best to focus on Strange Journey, if not just for sake of fishy. I like all these other branching in this series.
I think you guys have done a good job of like explaining how it relates to the broader series, and also how like it's hard to talk about any game in the series without talking about the other games.
It is a huge interconnected web. All kind of bleeds into each other. But Strange Journey, despite the lack of a number, as we said, is very firmly entrenched in the older school SMTs, where we didn't get any game in the series until the third one, SMT Nocturne, which was several years after the first two and a half, SNES titles. Right.
What I'd like for you guys to do is like to make kind of like your elevator pitch for why people should play this game or shouldn't. What I really want to hear is what you think is like the single coolest moment or the most like unique moment or thing that happens in the game or thing that you can do.
If I could summarize, like I've already said, it is basically a very gripping sci-fi plot. I mean, it is clearly a Mega Ten story, as it were, with its apocalyptic setting and its battle for humanity's fate against angels and gods and demons. But it is also very much entrenched in sci-fi tropes. It's a really brilliant plot, the way it's executed. Like, the plot line is, on paper, very much the Shin Megami Tensei mold, but it is filtered through this lens of a very recognizable kind of Western sci-fi. Like, the protagonists in a traditional Megami Tensei game are usually, like, ordinary people drafted into this role. Like, again, 4 will be an exception, since in the first one you are basically an elite badass samurai warrior, but in this one you are a super soldier recruited, armed with this badass armor and technology. You're basically the Doom Marine with a focus on communicating with and recruiting demons, as well as actually fighting. Like, you outfit your gear with skills. Like, instead of learning spells as per the traditional, instead of learning spells like your demons, if memory serves, it's been a long time since I last played it. Instead of learning spells, you instead augment your gun with various kinds of rounds you can use.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we should also mention, and this has been in all the SMT games before Strange Journey, but you don't use Pokeballs to capture demons. You have to bargain with them to join your team. Most of them are intelligent enough to hold conversations with you, and you have to, like, you know, either sweet talk them or kind of strong arm them. Sometimes you have to bribe them. It doesn't always work. Like, it is always a bit of a crapshoot, so you have to be kind of persistent if you want to build your team up, but it is a pretty novel mechanic, at least, so I've always found.
Demon conversations are an integral part of the Shin Megami Tensei experience. But there's also another element, fusion. Like, instead of where Pokemon has breeding, like, you can breed Pokemon to get new Pokemon with better stats, skills they normally wouldn't learn, etc. For Shin Megami Tensei, you can take demons who have learned skills you like, and then fuse them to make more powerful demons who have learned those same skills. There's a bit of a crapshoot there as well. Like, depending on the game, it's going to be kind of a trial and error process to get an output demon that has all the skills you like. Mm-hmm. Like, inheritance is kind of a random thing in the early games. Again, Shin Megami Tensei 4 makes an exception to this. You can pick and choose, which is a really, really awesome feature. But again, here you kind of have to back in and out of the interface to try and get the skills you want. And the thing is about fusion is that there are certain rules by which it works. Like, every demon in the game has a race to it, like Deity, Pitsy, Kishin, Tyrant, etc.
Fiend, I think, was one of them.
Fiends, oh yeah, those are classic. The fiends are
the
classic
super
element.
Bosses.
They're super bosses.
They're skeletons who want to murder you.
Yeah, they are skeletons who want to murder you. And they have a major plot-specific role in Shin Megami Tensei 3 also. I don't remember them having a plot-central role in Strange Journey, but I do remember that the one called David, who is basically this skeleton fiddler supposedly meant to represent the Danse Macabre, is pretty much thrown at you early on, like near the start of the second area. That's another interesting thing about Shin Megami Tensei Strange Journey's arrangement. Like, basically it is split up into 8 very strongly themed areas. Like, the first four are all based on, they're basically twisted mirror images of our world, each representing some kind of vice of humanity. Like, the first zone is a war zone. The second zone is basically a torture cellar. The third zone is a shopping mall from hell. And the fourth zone, the fourth zone is, if I recall, a garbage dump.
Oh,
and then
yeah.
we get to the more theoretical stuff. The fifth area is almost this Garden of Eden type location for most of it. And I'm trying to remember what the theme was, if any, for the remaining two.
Probably don't want to spoil too much at the end, though. If anyone wants to spoil.
Oh, by all means, don't want to spoil. But yeah, like I said, there's some really engaging plot threads in here. Like, this is very much a sci-fi story. Like, I can't really get into detail without spoiling what makes the story so interesting. It again, it follows a Megaten mold, and just saying that kind of hints at spoilers for what happens to your allies, Jimenez and Zelenin.
I feel that it's like a much more interesting take on the really standard seven deadly sins that every game seems to be doing nowadays. But yeah, it does take its sort of basic concept and really run with it. I also feel, though, that like the fact that there's like eight major stages is part of what distinguishes it from prior SMTs, because SMT games before this actually had a sprawling overworld to them where like all the different towns and dungeons were disconnected from each other.
Yeah.
Whereas here, it's like the only quote-unquote town you have is your ship, the Red Sprite.
Yeah.
And you have to return to that to go to all the various places. It's the hub world that all the rest of these stages are built around. And like as a result, though, the dungeons here are much larger than any other dungeons to have ever been seen in any of the games before.
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, Shin Megami Tensei: Strange Journey is very much a dungeon crawler, as it were. Like all the actual gameplay takes place in one of its. Well, let's be honest. Like the areas I've alluded to are basically all these sprawling dungeons you have to explore. But the flip side of that, as already discussed, is that your safe place, your hub zone, is your ship, and that really contributes to the feel of the game. Like that's where I failed, anyways. Mm-hmm. It lends to the sense that you are part of an exploratory expedition. Like things go wrong, and the plan has to change. You have to improvise, but at the same time, your purpose there is still pretty evident in how you do things. Like, you perform missions, you investigate the surroundings, you return to your ship and report in, and get new objectives. It keeps to a certain pattern of action that really lends to the feel of things.
Okay. Yeah, there's actually something else that I wanted to mention of how this game sets a bit more of a Western-esque tone that's also different from prior games, and that's in the sound design. Because prior SMTs have been, like, usually, like, I think more rocking and fast-paced, like, all right, this is going to be some crazy fighting here, in, like, how they set the music up. But Strange Journey is a lot more, I think, orchestral and ethereal, like, lots of trumpets, lots of,
I'm a big fan of the boss theme, the battle theme, the Fear of God, as well as the boss themes. I would say that the soundtrack in this game is just incredible, is what I mean to say.
Yeah.
But it is.
Yeah, that's the thing of it is, I normally don't go for that orchestral stuff, but it really just works with the atmosphere of this game. And what I think how it helps is that it always sounds very creepy. This game is extremely hostile and wants to kill you at every turn. And, you know, the music is usually telling you that. Like, this is a place of complete danger. You must always be wary, even if it, you know, just looks like the local produce stand in the case of the third area.
All right, so we got to start ranking this thing. What do you think we should do?
Yeah, are there any thoughts you want to wrap up with for you? Have we like covered the run of the game mostly comprehensively?
I would say most of it. There was one last thing I'm trying to remember what I was going to say.
Also, want to say that this as... No, wait, it's not the only DS installment.
Yeah, the Devil Survivor games were also on a DS. But I believe that with the release of Strange Journey Redux next year, we should have...
Right!
This is tiny. 3DS remakes of all the DS installments. But yeah, now I remember that the last thing I was going to say. One of my favorite little touches, though, is how the shop system works. Like, you don't buy and sell items. Instead, what you have is a manufacturing facility aboard the ship. Like, everything you buy can be broken down into energy, which can then be reconstructed back into matter. I mean, you've got this funky sci-fi tech that makes the classic RPG shop trope work. In fact, it even deals with the classic scenario. Like, how are you able... how does the shop get away with buying things back from you with just a tiny pittance compared to what you bought for? And it makes sense because, naturally, they shouldn't be able to break things down as efficiently as they can to build them up. It makes sense that there should be something lost in the conversion back and forth. Simple answer.
Yeah, it's like, it's basically a tax, more or less, but it works within the context of the game. Funny thing is, I'm playing Prey right now, and that sci-fi horror is all get out, and it works really similar with being able to recycle things and break them down to materials you then do to replicate stuff. So I don't know who invented the replicator concept in the first place, but yeah, it's just everything about this game's like sci-fi grand scale mashing with the classical mythologies and weird demon beasts of SMT. It is one of the most unique flavors for any RPG I've ever seen, and even within the SMT series, it's a very curious anomaly. And you know, except for the crushing difficulty, I think that's what makes it pretty great.
Yeah, it's weird, like. I remember the final boss of Strange Journey being a ton harder than the final boss of either 4 or 4 Apocalypse. And that brings me to one last thing.
Yeah.
There is a major demon character who, as far as I know, was first introduced in Strange Journey, who also makes an appearance in Shin Megami Tensei 4. But the thing is, he has such a role in Shin Megami Tensei Strange Journey that that's probably the one disappointment in all of Shin Megami Tensei 4, that his appearance in that game just does not live up to his role in Strange Journey. Mm. I would say more, but again, I'm trying to avoid getting into too huge spoilers. But trust me, you'll know this guy when you meet him.
Can I at least say that the character in question has its name begin with the 13th letter of the alphabet? Is that the one I'm thinking of?
Yes, you
gotcha,
may.
Gotcha. Okay. All right, well, in that case, I'm ready to rank this now, if everyone else is.
Sorry, my brain just shut down there for a minute.
Well,
yeah, go ahead. Sure, go ahead. Rank it. Let's rank it quickly.
All right. You're, I'd say, more the expert of the series than I am, so I'm primarily going to defer the judgment to you in this case. I can say that, as we've discussed, there is really a lot to like about this game, aesthetically and mechanically. But I do want to at least give the caveat for ranking that this game is not nice, as I've alluded to, and I'm wondering if its difficulty would potentially be a deal breaker for anyone looking into it.
Well, I will, like I said already, I remember putting this game down for a few months after getting my ass handed to me by the fifth floor boss.
I've heard that one is especially nasty. I didn't get that far yet, but
I would say that if nothing else, 4 and 4 Apocalypse might be a little easier to get into because they are easier to break in the player's favor. I mean, they're more.
Mm-hmm.
I won't get into details about the mechanics in SMT4 and 4 Apocalypse, which make them so easy to break in your favor, because also it should be pointed out these same mechanics are easy for the AI to break against you. But
it's a lot more chaotic. This one is more old school in its dungeon crawlerliness and stats, for better or worse.
Yeah,
and eventually, and this is my least favorite thing about dungeon crawlers, I think it was either the fourth or fifth area where the maps just get so insanely full of, like, traps, like poisons and spikes and freaking trapdoors that drop you in the floor below. Those are the freaking worst ever, and they should be banned.
The fifth area maze is not friendly.
And neither is the boss, so if that's the part that turns everybody away, it sounds understandable.
Yeah, so put another way, I strongly recommend Strange Journey, but I would concur that I do not recommend it as a first Mega 10. I would probably, if you want to dip into the old school style, I would probably have, if you want to delve into a mainline Mega 10, I would probably recommend 4 and then 4 Apocalypse and then the earlier games. If you want something more of a challenge, though, you might get spoiled again because once you've experienced 4 and 4 Apocalypse's ability to just pick and choose demon inherited skills instead of having to back in and out and hope that the RNG is kind this time, you might have issues with that. I would also recommend the Digital Devil Saga games just as an introduction to the aesthetic, at the very least.
Yeah, it's a good idea, yeah. There are several entry points. I would almost want to recommend Nocturne, which I feel is ultimately a bit easier than Strange Journey, but is still pretty vicious, especially early game hell with Matador and Thor. Those two are hatred.
Yeah.
All right, so again, to rank the game...
We're getting there.
Okay, so I'm trying to figure it out. We've got these top 227, or where are these the ranking?
Okay, I thought you got the list, though.
I got the list. I'm just trying to figure out. I mean, so basically we've got these 227 entries, all numerical. I was kind of in under the impression that we kind of assigned these numbers at random.
Sometimes. Well,
no, I mean, basically what we're trying to do here.
Okay, well, all I can say is I see Riven the sequel to Myst at 1979, and as much as I like this game, I would have to rank it under that. So let's see here.
What? Wow, dude, that's really low. I'm surprised.
You did not like Riven, so...
Yeah,
like,
oh, wow. That's blasphemy. That is blasphemy.
Okay, it's their fault. I washed my hands of it. I was going to... I kept telling them fans would throw... with Coke bottles.
Oh, wow. It's only like what? It's only like what? You only ranked it like 18 slots
everything
above Shaq Fu?
Yeah, well, everything is relative to everything else we've ranked, so... Like, the top of the list and the bottom of the list are very heavy on, you know, really good and really bad games, respectively. And in between, it's kind of like, it depends on, you know, it's a little bit more up in the air. So,
okay. Riven is what one I would of recommend the few is anomalies.
I would look at, games in the, like, from the way you guys are describing it and how much you seem to like it, I'd be looking at, like, the Morrowind range, which is currently ranked at number 77.
Yeah, that's a much better starting point as far as comparing RPGs go. So, Ryu, do you like Strange Journey more than Morrowind?
Having never played Morrowind or an Elder Scrolls of any sort, except maybe like for a few minutes, maybe an hour that's tops fair. And that was Oblivion, I'm pretty sure. Let's see here. Mm-hmm. Let's put it in at... Let's make it 64. Nice round number.
That would be between which two games that you're seeing, then?
Okay, I'm looking at it's right where Mega Man 3 is.
All right, between Mega Man 3 and R-Type?
Actually, it would be between Mega Man 3 and Crash Bandicoot 2.
I can look at that.
Okay, that is actually completely fair. A great game on a lot of aesthetics, but it's, punishing difficulty might not be up everyone's angle, and the SMT series is really weird as a whole, so I understand if someone's not into them. I mean, I really like the old-school games. I don't like Persona as much, but...
So Shin Megami Tensei, Strange Journey goes...
Strange Journey!
Goes right below Crash Bandicoot 2, right above Mega Man 3.
Hello everyone, Jeff the Electric Viking here. You might remember me as the biggest Superscalar fan in the world, or perhaps as the resident Bad at Games guy. Nevertheless, I've had the good fortune of working with the HD101 gang for over a year now, and I have a stake in seeing the outfit continue to move from strength to strength, and that's where you come in. I would humbly ask if you consider a small monthly contribution to HD101 on Patreon. Your money funds paid writing on the video games that you love, helps fund this show, and on top of that, you'll gain access to an add-on version of the HD101 podcast, with bonus content every week. All of this can be had for the price of a coffee, beer, or whatever the hell it is you drink in your corner of the world. Thanks for your consideration. And remember, be sure to have your pets spayed or neutered.
Okay, the next game we're talking about is El Viento, which was nominated by @SuperHappy. On Twitter, it was developed by Wolf Team and published by Wolf Team and Renovation Products. Wolf Team in Japan published it, and Renovation published it in the United States for the Mega Drive or Genesis. Early release date and territory is September 20th, 1991 in Japan. So El Viento by Wolf Team. This is the second in the Ernest Evans trilogy, correct?
I forget if this was actually the one that... Oh, no. It says it's second. It was 1990... Okay, I think it is technically the second in a story sense, but I think Ernest Evans was actually released after that, so Ernest was a prequel. Like Temple of Doom rules with Indiana Jones and all that. Although it does feel like Ernest should have been the one that came first, in a way, because it... well, I would like to discuss Ernest Evans sometime, but game is more straightforward.
So El Viento is about... Okay, so I'm going to try to recap the plot.
Oh, God, it's kind of ludicrous.
Okay, so what I think happens is I think it's about there's a doomsday cult that worships Haster.
Yeah,
right?
The King in Yellow.
Like a, is a Lovecraftian horror. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And the year is 1928, but in this version of 1928, the Empire State Building, the Chrysler Building, they're all already up and fully. In real life, neither of those buildings, I think, were started until 1931.
Yeah.
But it also has a lot of other. I mean, those are the least of its anachronisms, and we'll get into the rest of them later. So they're trying to resurrect or summon or something Haster, the evil abomination from beyond the borders of sanity or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And so the cult leader teams up with Al Capone.
Yep.
For some reason. Al Capone, by the way, not a New York gangster. So there's another problem.
Also, he doesn't look like Al Capone in the game. He's not drawn like Al Capone at all. He's just some, like, blonde guy, isn't he?
Yeah. Anime Capone. I mean, you know, Japan kind of takes liberties with historical figures sometimes. Apparently, though, he's been retranslated as Vicente DiMarcato in outside the Japanese localization. So it's kind of like Satan and Tanzra.
I guess it could have been a lot worse, like, in terms of names, right? Have you
guys
seen that thing that's been going around Twitter lately of like some 90s baseball video game?
Oh yeah, Sleeve McDykel.
Sleeve McDykel. It could have been Onsen Swimmy or Sweeney.
Bobson Dugnut or whatever.
Bobson Dugnut's the favorite. I like Tony Smerick. another good one is Raoul Chamberlain. Not Chamberlain, Chamberlain. Raoul Chamberlain.
It feels like you're trying to put, like, real names into, like, a Japanese text-to-speech translator.
It's so close. Todd Gonzalez.
I mean, I can tell you exactly what happened with that, and it's that they romanized it and then just chopped off letters that they knew weren't in English, because you guys know how Japanese works, so it makes a lot of sense when you look at it. They took American names that had been turned into pronounceable to the Japanese alphabet, and then they changed it back to English, and then took out the bits the Japanese added without knowing which bits they actually added, and so you got this fantastic array of names.
Okay, but that means I still need to know who Mario McRoyne is. Or Anatoly Smorin.
Is Anatoly Smorin in the game that we're talking about?
That was Bases Loaded, just to clarify, right?
Damn it!
No. Okay, so anyway, back to the plot. So Al Capone and the cult leader are in cahoots, see? And it's 1928, and they can only be stopped by some chick. There's a young woman. What's her name again?
Annette Futatavi, which sounds a little bit like a dirty Japanese word, but isn't quite. I think she's retranslated as, like, Annette Meyer in other versions, but she's, like, this Peruvian, like, nature combat sorceress wizard. She's basically, like, I don't know, Princess Nausicaa. Like, she feels like an anime hero put into this, you know, American setting that's attempting a Lovecraft plot. So it's a really weird blend of mediums smashing together.
All the cultists are very Japanese anime cultists. It's just like huge robes, 80s hairstyles, just out the wazoo here.
Wait, shoot, her name was always Annette Meyer. Annette Futatavi is actually the sequel to this game, the Sega CD, which was very mediocre.
So she's supposed to be like a local girl, right? Like,
yeah, she's not imported. She's just hanging out.
But for some reason, she dresses like a combination of, like, the goddess Athena and an aerobics instructor. Like,
it's an interesting fashion statement for the late 1920s.
She has both boomerangs and magic powers, and she can jump about three or four stories in the air.
Oh, and also dash across the ground, like, just crouch.
She has a ninja run.
She's got one of the best animated, like, turnaround cycles on the Genesis.
Yeah. Like, I will say up front that this game does have some pretty rad graphics with one exception.
Well, about 80% of the graphics were put into that one turn.
Yeah.
It looks good. They did a good turn.
Yeah.
It looks really good, and it does really well in the air as well. The character, she just spin when you turn in air.
You can tell
really
where the game's
cool
art director's, like, priorities were.
Slightly off-putting anime cutscene graphics.
Yes. And they're pretty good. For 1991, they're great. I mean, at the time, like, so this game, so the way it plays is basically, like, it's like a fast magician lord. How about that?
Hey, you know what? That's actually a fair thing to get behind. And once again, same year as the first Sonic the Hedgehog, which That always baffles me that Sonic was released that late, but... gameplay is pretty... relatively straightforward action platforming. Kill the enemies before they kill you, which can be difficult sometimes.
Not very good.
And, like, the game seems kind of inconsistent with its invincibility hitbox, because you will get...
I don't think you have invincibility. I think some enemies just can't hit you repeatedly.
So it's, like, a really weird distortion of what I call a turrican health, where... it's like some enemies can just really drain quickly by just existing.
Oh yeah, like in the, even in the first stage, like the motorcycle dudes. Oh yeah, there are motorcycle like punk rockers in 1928. Yeah. Because hey, so is there something that's happening in the story that explains like all the anachronisms? Is like the like proximity of Haster to our dimension like distorting space time and creating?
I'm just going to say yes and roll with it because that's just. You know, a Lovecraft fiction is just inexplicable and occasionally racist, but that's neither here nor there. Now this game, like, although I will say, though, I kind of wish that weird, anachronistic feeling would extend beyond the first level, but I think for the most part, you're going through, like, more fantasy-like inspired planes and caverns, and, you do return sometimes to... you know, more modernish and mechanical settings.
You mean
but,
the giant, superfluous car manufacturing recycling plant?
Oh, yeah, right. No, wait, that is a part late in the game. It, like, keeps pinging back and forth between these American-made, like, you know, super industry constructs and, like, these...
Because you remember the whole Ford first Legends level. Of the Hidden Temple. They famously invented the automated car plant. You know, they actually had a fully automated robotic system. To handle their
they invented it right after they invented that hover tank you fight at the end of the first stage.
Oh yeah,
yes. Hover tanks.
I hate that tank.
Yeah.
The game okay, so I basically the game like the first stage is I think like grade A America Town type thing. What I like about it is that it's like you know the standard city level trope, right? Where you're climbing up the outside of buildings. And then there's, like, periodically, like, some dude will, like, show up in a window and either take a pot shot at you or dump some garbage on you or something, right?
Yeah.
In this game, the bad guys have, like, all right, we are going to rent every room in this building and we're all going to do this pretty much in unison. And they're, like, it's just dude after dude just showing up in the window just, like, you know, it's, like, it's just, like, a wave. They're, like, doing the wave. It's, like, a human wave out the window sometimes.
It's cool that you mention that because it really brings forth that this game doesn't... it actually has more of a Euro design in that sense. You are meant to get hit in this game. Quite often, it really piles on, like, stuff that's going to hit you.
I don't recall a lot of health refills, though, right?
They're kind of hidden in sort of out-of-the-way places. There's a couple that you can find. The game has a lot of dead ends in a lot of the levels, and about 1 in 15 of those will have a health, or there are points where you can dig through parts of the stage by throwing your boomerang through solid brick. And when that happens, sometimes there's a health hidden in one of those bricks or planks of wood. It really is kind of not really sure what it's doing, but it has that in there. It doesn't like if you die, though. It kicks you back to the start of the stage.
Which can be a significant setback,
And you only get three.
Yeah, it's not unfair, and the other thing I'll say in its credit, and then I think we should just go ahead and rank it, because I'm not really sure what else to say about it. Well, no, I can say two things. Okay, so the first thing is I want to say is, like, on the city stage, the thing I like most about that is that they do a good job of making sure the platforms all make sense. Like, they're actually, like, fire escapes, or they're dangling from, like, a rooftop or something, and you'll see, like, some... it's just something that most platformer-type run-and-gun-whatever games don't usually bother to do. It's kind of weird at first because you think it's just background scenery and stuff. I can climb up that fire escape. I can jump onto that thing. The other thing is, I guess, like what this series or what this game is most famous for, in a way, is being kind of like the gateway drug to anime for an entire generation of dorks.
Oh, yeah.
So it's like at the time, 1991, like this could very well be your first exposure to the whole concept or the whole style.
Right, there were a few games that had that sort of hiding in it. And that's, I guess, one of the closest things about this game is that, and I think maybe the developer worked on these before, but it really has a Japanese PC game feel, you know, 88, 98.
Like Rusty or whatever.
Sort of sense to it, as opposed to a Mega Drive game. And that's kind of where it gets awkward for me, because this game is... very
indeed broke-ass. Indeed it is.
There's
what you can tell when a game has not had, shall we say, sufficient polish, when like the areas where you're supposed to drop down or go downstairs or something. Like you have to hit, you have to be just right over it, because otherwise you won't pass through the opening. You'll just be standing in basically thin air. It happened to me so many times where I'm like, I gotta get down the staircase, but there's like a huge ledge that juts out right into the staircase.
Yeah,
right. Because the characters are pretty big in this. Nice big sprites.
Oh, nice big sprites.
Satenga, tell me about the big sprites.
Oh yeah, I did want to mention. I believe this was level 4. You're at the beginning of level 4. You're riding on a dolphin across the ocean, and you know, you're taking out like, whatever, like hang glider bombers or whatever. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, a gigantic freaking Cthulhu-like super squid who is horribly pixelated just fills up the entire right half of the screen. But like, he only takes like 2 hits before he explodes. I have never been able to figure out what is the purpose of this entity. If someone put it in there as a gag, or if there you know, was some sort of like inside developer reason why this weird squid... I mean, also I should note that whenever there's a big explosion, it's also rather gaucially pixely.
It's really strange. It's like they looked at like arcade games, you know, how they have like scaling explosions that start small and then they use the actual... scaling effect to get really big, and it's like, whoa, it's a cool explosion. But because they couldn't do that, because the Genesis doesn't really have scaling, and they, you know, it would take too much processing power to figure it out.
Yeah.
They just start the explosions at like the size of the screen, and they just like boom, and then they go on. It's like, what the hell was that?
Yeah, it's like most of the enemy's sprites look all right, but that effect is just strange, and I still don't know what the. It is one of the greatest question marks I've ever seen in a video game. To this day, I have no idea what's with the super squid. Like, I guess they just wanted a really good true to this Cthulhu appearance, but why he's beaten so easily? Why he's not like more of a proper fight or whatever?
I think it was a labor of love. I think it was something that was kind of snuck into the game by legendary programmer Dwight Wartugal.
You're ready for that beast.
Okay, so let's rank it.
All right. Well, I did like this game a lot in earlier times. I liked it enough to, and you can say this is untrue, I've actually beaten it. I just, like, got into it enough that
I believe you're committed enough to beat this game. It's not a hard game, except in a few instances where it's damn near impossible, which, again, is a bit...
Its difficulty is bumpy up and down here and there, but it's not too much more out of the realm of what you'd see from other action platformers. So, you know, yeah, if you're familiar with games like this in this lead, you will be, I think, mostly ready for most of it. Except for the final level. I don't know if any of you have gotten this far or have seen level 8. It is full of these bats who home in on you, drain your life, and are infinite and are hard to hit. And you have to go all and up and down this building, like apartment complex or whatever. And it is horrible. I mean...
I can't believe this game doesn't finish on a space level. Like, what the hell?
You need the robot dragon, like, Wonder Boy style. Like,
no, actually, honestly, yeah, the final level is just, like, this giant high-rise building, which feels a little anticlimactic, because the level prior to that is,
you think
like
they were going for King Kong?
Maybe.
That kind of says King Kong.
Maybe it's Ghostbusters, kind of.
But it's not quite as fantastic as this awesome, like, Egyptian-looking Zeppelin level that's just the entirety of level 7. That looked quite a bit cooler than what this is, but it's...
So, looking at the list here, I got to put it below Ninja Gaiden, but I could put it above Far Cry and Tetris Attack simply because it is artistically amusing.
Huh.
Any game with Al Capone in it is okay with me. Al Capone plus Cthulhu, I mean, that's double okay.
There is a lot I like about this game's style, but a lot of its execution just feels inconsistent. And
that's an understatement. It's an absolute mess.
It's definitely not
this
held
game
up
was
well
made
over time.
By like someone like a few years ago in Game Factory. I'd be like, yeah, I think that's right. I think that someone made it in that, because it is so slapdash. Look. I don't know, like, I would put it substantially lower because I don't think it's better than E-SWAT.
That's true.
Siege.
Okay, maybe we do got to put it lower. Well, okay, so I got to put it... Okay, so how...
No, I mean, I'll hear from Satenga before we go too far, but because I think that E-SWAT is almost this, but kind of more consistent and more polished, and I think that that's kind of... I think this game Polish is one of the hardest things to put in a game.
Yeah.
So I think that by being unpolished, it really shows that they were like, what about, well, we made it, so we're done.
What about above Cruising USA, below Mortal Kombat? It's hard to argue that it's better than Mortal Kombat.
I mean,
Mortal Kombat's not great, but I mean...
It's got more historical importance, unless we're going to go with the anime thing. I mean... I can see that.
I mean, maybe
I'll notch it one above Mortal Kombat because the original MK is kind of hard to get back to. MK2, there's no question, but I do think between Road Rash and Mortal Kombat, is much as I liked this game, I think it's pretty fair as far as its accessibility and current appeal is concerned. Now,
I second that motion, which means that's where it goes, right below Road Rash, right above Mortal Kombat. So currently at number 174.
All right,
on our big damn list.
I know that my main man Rob likes this game quite a bit. I'm not sure, or did like it a bit. So I apologize if he wouldn't favor, but I gotta say, I really like
this game's little bit of technical things that it does. There's a really cool boss where it uses the raster sort of like scrolling effect to like make a blob that distorts across the screen. It's really cool, and the game is full of that, and it's also full of shit.
Yeah, it is just a cyclone of good and bad ideas just swirling around and refusing to settle down in any one place. So just because of how sloppy it feels, it has to hit a low-ish, but not bad placement.
It's
just
the best of old school and the worst of old school.
It's around the Technocop lower medium vanguard area, so I think it's what it deserves.
Okay, what a fascinating duology of game discussions and rankings. But you know what? There were actually three of them. That's right, suckers. We talked about Terradome in our Patreon bonus section. And what do people need to know about Terradome? Why would they want to hear us rank that one?
Lots of 80s slasher icons being the stuffing out of each other. Pretty much it.
Works for me. And that's just one of the many great things you get by donating $2 or more a month on patreon.com/HG101. You up that donation, I think $5, you'll get the three most recent Hardcore Gaming 101 books in PDF form. That's a great deal. And the more you give, the more you get. It just goes up from there. So that's all for this episode of Hardcore Gaming 101's Top Games Podcast. Special thanks goes out to @SuperHappy on Twitter and @LeadyBear on iTunes for nominating those games. Thanks as well to those of you we haven't gotten to yet. We hope to get to you as fast as we can. Thanks as well to my lovely co-host, the compatriots, to our editor, Jeff Rude, our theme song composer, Miteki, our technical assistant, video editor, and scriptwriter, Bobinator. And of course, thank you, listeners, for your support and feedback. You can support this podcast even further by making a small monthly donation at patreon.com/HG101. I know I did. And you can help us out by following @GC9X and @HG_101 on Twitter. But you can also, and there's more opportunities for interaction here, because you can hang out with us on our burgeoning Discord channel chat thing at bit.ly/HG Discord. But most importantly, help us claw our way into the podcast firmament by getting on iTunes, subscribing to HG101, and giving us a 5-star review. Do it, or we'll introduce our new podcast mascot, Lil Mara.
Trust me, you don't want us to introduce Lil Mara.
Until next week, keep keeping it real.